Remotely detonated personal devices in Lebanon are raising new concerns about security, and not just in conflict zones.
The average person or company or government may stop and have to question the integrity of the products they're using in their daily lives.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, updates from the border between Israel and Lebanon and clarity on the security of our devices.
Plus, high school and college kids are carrying drugs across the U.S.-Mexico border. They're being targeted by cartels who call them blind mules.
They are carrying fentanyl. They have it strapped on their body.
Why that's happening.
And an Irish musician opens up her heart in her newest music.
It is quite a personal album.
That's all ahead today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us. Hezbollah's leader today called it a severe blow. The attacks this week that caused pagers and walkie-talkies across Lebanon to explode. In a speech, Hassan Nasrallah also promised that Hezbollah will continue attacking Israel until the war in Gaza ends.
Later in the day, Israel's military claimed it struck about 30 Hezbollah sites in Lebanon, including numerous rocket launchers aimed at Israeli territory. The World's Matthew Bell has been following all of this. He's in our studio. What else struck you in Nasrallah's speech, Matthew?
Yeah, the leader of Hezbollah is not one to give Israel credit for anything, really. He refers to the country as a cancerous tumor that must be removed. But he did call this attack unprecedented. He denounced it as a crossing all red lines. He called it a massacre. Remember, Marco, this attack killed 36 people at least. It injured around 3,000 people. It might have taken down Hezbollah's entire communication system. Today, Nasrallah also said this was a declaration of war. He said that Israel will meet a just punishment. Also today, Iran, which supports Hezbollah, said that Israel will face a crushing response from the axis of resistance. But most experts don't think that either Iran or Hezbollah want an all-out war with Israel right now. And there wasn't anything in the speech that really seemed to clearly contradict that.
Well, we still have Hezbollah fighters along the border. They're clearly not backing down. In fact, the Israeli military said that today two of its soldiers were killed near the border with Lebanon. What are Israeli leaders saying about what might come next?
There are signs that Israel is at the very least preparing for a bigger war with Hezbollah. Early today, the Israeli military said its chief of staff reviewed and approved new battle plans for the Northern Front. That means Lebanon. It's also been moving some troops and equipment from Gaza up to northern Israel. Israel's defense minister today, Yoav Gallant, also said that military action against Hezbollah will continue. He called this a new phase of the war against Hezbollah that he said will have both risks and opportunities. You also mentioned the bombing today in southern Lebanon, Marco. That has continued with cross-border fire from Hezbollah almost daily since October 7th last year. I think the big question now, though, is if Israel is planning to launch a ground offensive into Lebanon, especially now that Hezbollah is reeling from this recent attack.
So Israeli leaders also recently said that getting some 60,000 people who evacuated northern Israel back into their homes is now one of their war objectives. But with the specter of more war, what does that mean?
So this is new. After the Hamas attack on October 7th, Hezbollah started firing rockets, drones at Israeli towns and cities in the north. That prompted tens of thousands of Israelis to get out of their homes. They've been living, many of them, in hotels ever since then. The Israeli government now says that either Hezbollah forces need to move away from the border with Israel, those people, those Israelis need to be able to go back to their homes in the north, or the Israeli military will use force to create a buffer zone in southern Lebanon. The last war between Israel and Lebanon was in 2006. Since then, the sense among a lot of Israelis is that sooner or later they will need to go to war again with Hezbollah. I know this is something, Marco, that you heard when you visited northern Israel earlier this year.
Right.
But for months now, the Biden administration has been saying they do not want a wider war. They've been conducting shuttle diplomacy with Israel, with all of the neighbors, trying to get a ceasefire in place for Gaza, which U.S. officials say is really the best way to prevent a new war between Israel and Lebanon and maybe even the wider region. In fact, Secretary of State Antony Blinken is back in the Middle East this week. Once again, he's repeating this same message about containing the conflict.
The World's Matthew Bell, thank you very much for the updates on this quickly evolving fighting.
Thank you.
Many questions remain about the state of the conflict between Israel and Lebanon. There are also a lot of security questions that were raised by the attack this week that turned pagers and walkie-talkies into improvised explosives. Richard Forno helped us break down some of those concerns and questions. He's the assistant director of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County Cybersecurity Institute.
This attack stands out because of the scope involved. It wasn't just targeting a single person. It was targeting many hundreds of targets. And the fact that this was coordinated, apparently there was a lot of planning and effort that went into this to find people to place inside these distribution centers, to tamper with the pagers. There was a lot of, you know, preparation involved. So the scope and scale of both the preparation and the ultimate effect really makes this a noteworthy incident or a noteworthy attack.
Now, Hezbollah was relying more on pagers and walkie-talkies in the first place to communicate because of the trackability of cell phones. Why are these older technologies harder to track?
Well, pagers are older technology, and depending on the type of pager you have, it makes it much more difficult to be tracked. Many pagers are one way, meaning they could receive a signal, but they can't transmit. So in that case, the pager is essentially invisible. There's no way to actually locate the person receiving the signal. That's what makes it more challenging for intelligence and surveillance to track these individuals, which is presumably why Hezbollah was using pagers.
How unusual is it for a nation state, as opposed to a terrorist group, to turn something like pagers and walkie-talkies into explosive devices?
It's certainly an innovative approach. Normally, we do see terrorists taking advantage of everyday technologies. I think back to the shoe bomber, Richard Reed, 15 or so years ago, turned everyday things we wear, our shoes, into a weapon. And as a result, it changed airport security around the world. It's not unfathomable that a nation state would use these techniques. But what does concern me about the number of pagers that were involved is how many pagers might have injured an innocent bystander who may have been given the pager and they had nothing to do with, you know, terrorist activities or political activities, or they were in the vicinity or they were holding it at the moment it went off. There are political and legal questions around this type of an attack being launched by a nation state that the lawyers will need to figure out over time.
How easy or hard is it to turn something like a pager into an improvised explosive device?
Well, a single pager, it would not be that difficult. Or a single cell phone. The Israelis in the past have tampered with a single cell phone to target and kill terrorist leaders back in the 1990s. But to do it at scale, where we're talking about hundreds or thousands of devices, having it go unnoticed, that really requires a lot of effort to coordinate and implement. So that's, I think, worth noting in this particular scenario.
You mentioned the shoe bomber, the attempted shoe bomber many years ago. We still take our shoes off at TSA checkpoints. Should travelers expect that things like pagers and walkie-talkies will no longer be allowed on planes?
It's possible. Security is always, changing with the times, or it should be dynamic and adapt. I think that would cause more problems, though, because the traveling public has become used to having a device with them to check their travel, their boarding, their tickets are on their phones now. So prohibiting devices on planes, I think, is going to be very problematic for the industry and for society as a whole.
Richard Forno is the assistant director at the UMBC Cybersecurity Institute.
The armed forces of the U.S. and China seldom see eye to eye, but at least they are talking. A top Chinese military commander recently met online with the head of the U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, marking the first high-level military call between these superpowers in 2 years. And according to officials on the U.S. side, it was a constructive and respectful exchange of views, though the U.S. admiral also chided his Chinese counterpart for dangerous, coercive, and potentially escalatory tactics in the South China Sea. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports on whether anything's expected to change coming out of the meeting.
Too often, when the U.S. and Chinese militaries talk, it's over a staticky radio. A People's Liberation Army officer in a fighter jet telling a U.S. jet, back off.
American aircraft, this is the PLA Air Force. You are approaching Chinese airspace. Keep a safe distance or you'll be intercepted.
That's a warning to a U.S. Navy jet cruising over waters south of China, in audio obtained by CNN. Run-ins like this happen, on average, every week, often over parts of the map China claims, but the U.S. routinely buzzes through to say, no, these are international waters. each side's fighter jets will fly so close the pilots can see each other's faces. Accidents could lead to death, misunderstandings, and all-out conflict.
Small, mundane interactions can escalate very, very swiftly.
Nick Bisley is a China-focused professor of international relations at La Trobe University in Australia. 2 years ago, China ended military communications with the U.S. as punishment for then-House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visiting Taiwan.
The PRC took the opportunity to really take a big step back and to say, you know, you are the guys who are causing the problem, so we are going to disengage.
He says today's visit is a big step in a better direction. General Wu Yanan heads the Chinese military's Southern Command, covering a zone where U.S. fighter jets and warships often visit, against China's wishes. Those U.S. jets and ships are commanded by the man he's meeting for the first time, Admiral Samuel Paparo, head of U.S. Indo-Pacific Command. If jets crash into one another or warships accidentally collide, these two would need to talk it out, fast.
Given how tense things are, how heavily armed both these states are, we need as much communication between these two countries as possible.
With Chinese and American generals meeting again, there's much talk of establishing a 24-hour crisis hotline. What many don't realize is there's already a hotline, says Drew Thompson. He's a former U.S. defense official who managed military relations with China. The hotline is not a big red phone sitting on a general's desk.
Hotline is misleading. It's basically an elaborate Skype, Zoom, internet connectivity, but it's done with encrypted equipment on both sides.
Thompson is now a senior fellow at the Rajaratnam School of International Studies in Singapore. He once helped maintain the Defense Telephone Link. That's the hotline's proper title. He says the idea of a hotline gives American officials comfort. Two level-headed generals hashing it out, mano a mano, makes sense in America's military system, which endows individual commanders with great authority to act.
In China, there's no one person empowered to pick up the phone and speak authoritatively to their counterpart in the U.S. Everything is determined by committees.
So when the U.S. calls, Beijing often won't pick up, especially when there's a crisis. Thompson says because China knows the Pentagon is fixated on this hotline, it uses that fact to extract concessions.
The U.S. pushes very hard to get a phone call in, and they'll say, well, what are you going to do to justify the phone call?
China claims international waters far beyond its borders and often rams ships belonging to other nations to assert its authority. This includes ships belonging to a U.S. ally, the Philippines. Another China expert, Joshua Eisenman at the University of Notre Dame, says this aggression won't be cured by more phone calls or more FaceTime.
We continue to fight for these things under the presumption that they'll help reduce risks. We want this so bad, but I don't see how it actually protects the peace in the region.
Chinese leader Xi Jinping hasn't given a reason why he's warming up U.S. military ties. China's economy is in rough shape. And perhaps Xi doesn't need any flare-ups with U.S. forces on top of his other problems. Also, ties aren't that warm yet, with American politicians still condemning China as a dictatorship and Chinese generals still casting America as a warmonger. That's a Chinese general, Jing Jianfeng, in a recent speech, saying egotistical America always does whatever it wants. From Afghanistan to Iraq to Ukraine to Gaza. The U.S. will choose a new president soon, and that too could determine whether U.S.-China military talks backslide. Still, Professor Nick Bisley says, to much of the world, Kamala Harris and Donald Trump both look pretty hawkish on China.
The most likely set of outcomes, regardless of who wins the election in November, is that U.S.-China relations get worse than it get better.
For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen. Bangkok.
You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. During his election campaign, former President Trump has blamed migrants unauthorized to cross the southern border for smuggling fentanyl into the U.S. In fact, the smuggling is mostly done by U.S. citizens. And in a disturbing development, cartels are increasingly using high school and college students to do the job. In 2022, 26 minors were charged with drug smuggling. As Gustavo Solis reports from KPBS in San Diego, this year that number is on track to be even higher.
It's very concerning to see these young high school kids.
That is San Diego District Attorney Summer Steffen.
And they are carrying fentanyl. They have it strapped on their body, you know, risking their own health.
Over the last 3 years, she has seen a steady increase in minors prosecuted for drug smuggling. For decades, Mexican drug cartels have made San Diego a key hub in their drug trafficking networks.
The organized crime that's involved is smart enough to try to select people that can cross through the border without a criminal record so that their detection is at a lower level.
Fentanyl is the ideal drug for this type of smuggling. Small quantities of the powerful narcotic fetch big profits. So there's no need for the boats, planes, and underground tunnels that cartels have historically used to transport drugs like marijuana and cocaine. Sydney Aki is the director of field operations at the Customs and Border Protection's San Diego field office. He says cartels look for people who cross frequently and are desperate for cash. High school and college students often fit the bill.
They prey on individuals that potentially are on financial hardship. And they utilize these individuals to try and bring narcotics into the United States. They're getting paid a small nominal fee, maybe a Apple iPhone or Android phone or something to that nature, which they really cherish and want.
There are also people smuggling fentanyl without even knowing it. The practice is so common that Border Patrol agents have a name for it. They call it being a blind mule. This almost happened to two students at Southwestern College in Chula Vista. GPS tracking devices were found on the undercarriage of their cars. Here is Southwestern's chief safety officer, Marco Vareño.
We were able to see what appeared to be a young gentleman get out of the passenger side and attached a device underneath the car, which matched the location in which the student had found it. So that information was provided to the federal authorities.
Vareño believes that smugglers targeted the students because they crossed the border often. Drugs can be planted in a car in Tijuana and then picked up in the southwestern parking lot without anyone finding out.
We're all creatures of habit, right? We usually park in the same location because it's in proximity to your classes, so it's easy to track that car. You have it identified, you know where they park. You track it for a few days to see what time frames they're in, and it's easy pickup and drop off.
Campus police are now warning new students during orientation.
It would be irresponsible for our department to say this doesn't happen because we don't hear about it. So we need to be conscious that this is going on. For every two or three that you actually spot, how many you don't.
Steffen is also counting on education and awareness to combat fentanyl smuggling. Her office recently posted a billboard in El Cajon showing the faces of dozens of San Diegans killed by fentanyl.
I was just with 32 San Diego families who've lost children and loved ones. We were putting up a billboard that was driven by these families with the faces of their children and their siblings.
That's part of a larger outreach effort that involves visiting San Diego's high schools to warn people about the dangers of getting caught up in the drug trade.
The recruitment is very active, and what the cartels tell these kids is that nothing's going to happen to you.
But with more than 700 San Diegans dying from overdoses every year, Steffen says the consequences are very real. For The World, I'm Gustavo Solis, San Diego.
And now from Ireland, the sounds of singer-songwriter Susan O'Neill.
We're all crying out for what we crave, oh, but I'm begging for some truth.
O'Neill has won a bunch of awards and accolades in Ireland. She's now hoping to achieve the same recognition in the U.S. with the release of a new album. It's called Now in a Minute. O'Neill spoke with us recently about what was on her mind as she made this new music.
The themes throughout the album
really encompass, I suppose, life and evolving. It is quite a personal album, but it really is trying to draw into the power of the presence and all of the things within that that were essential for me in terms of growing up. Sovereignty, joy, heartbreak, addiction, depression, overcoming these types of things and just really owning those things, owning my flaws and owning the beauty and the things I love and hate about myself and other things and just wearing them all proudly. I'm an honest kind of liar. So one example would be Drive, which came to me very quickly in one sitting. The song was about owning the things that I suppose I'd be proud of and owning the things I would be both also embarrassed about as a person. And in the telling of this proudly, that the power is put back into the person rather than given to anybody else observing, and that it was to celebrate both of these things within myself. I come from a family that were very aware of music and the power of it. It was very much encouraged just to always play and always sing, and to sing not just songs that we would learn, nursery rhymes, but just to sing what you felt as well, just to sing into being, your actuality. So I always knew that it was always something that was a way of life. It was a doing, it was a playing, and it was a being. I'd like to close with one more song from the album, which is called Sign of the Times. I was driving as the streets are fading, looking round a memory. And this song was a kind of came into being when I suppose, like most people, I would just pay attention to a little bit of gentrification that was happening in my locality and realizing it's going on all over the world. And it's kind of, I guess, progress is one thing and it's important to acknowledge change, but then sometimes it's fundamental that we also pay attention and see some of the things that maybe aren't working or maybe that move too fast. And I really think as an artist it's important for us to use our voices to speak about these things and just to notice, you know, not all changes occurring very quickly are good and that we can do better sometime. And all of the people,
they call it just a sign of the time. That's Irish singer-songwriter Susan O'Neill. Now in a Minute is her new album. It drops tomorrow. We'll be right back. You're with the world. Artificial intelligence. Depending on whom you ask, it's an exciting new frontier or an existential threat. Either way,
it's very hard to maintain civil society and democracy when you don't know if you're interacting with a human or not.
A new proposal for nations to work together on a framework for AI. That's still ahead here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Nagorno-Karabakh is a disputed region within the borders of Azerbaijan. It has historically been inhabited by a majority Armenian population. This time last year, towns and villages in the enclave were shelled by Azerbaijan's military. More than 100,000 terrified Armenian residents fled. The World's Daniel Offman recently visited southern Armenia, the region where those who were first displaced arrived after fleeing their homeland.
The first columns of vehicles began arriving in Armenia a year ago today. Many of the Karabakh Armenians didn't even get a chance to pack, and they left everything behind. Videos online show tens of thousands of people driving away from Nagorno-Karabakh.
They fled Nagorno-Karabakh and went on this road where I'm standing on the way to the town of Gorizia. Many of them stayed there for some time before going elsewhere to Armenia or leaving the country altogether.
Most of them continued their journey north to the Armenian capital of Yerevan, but many stayed in Sunik province in southern Armenia, the area closest to Nagorno-Karabakh. Father Michael Gevorgian, a priest in the Armenian Apostolic Church, was there to greet them. Almost all the clergy from Sunik were there, helping people and praying for them. Father Gevorgian says that when he saw the people arriving from Nagorno-Karabakh, he was speechless.
Можно сказать, мы плакали, не могли говорить.
We cried. When I tried to speak, I wept. How can you see this and not weep? Father Gevorgian serves at the Tatev Monastery, which has been a place of worship for Armenian Christians since the 9th century. Father Gevorgian says that in difficult times he finds solace in ancient Armenian songs and prayers. In the nearby village of Shinuhaid, I meet Raya Makian and her daughter. Makian lived in Nagorno-Karabakh for most of her life. For 9 months, Azerbaijan had laid siege to Nagorno-Karabakh. But Makian says they weren't expecting war.
We didn't know that the war would start. We were gathering together at the cemetery to visit our familial gravesites. That's when we heard the sounds, the shooting and the explosions, those scary noises.
Makian says that night she and other family members slept in their basement. Most of the family left Nagorno-Karabakh about a week later. When I ask her about what she misses most, she talks about nature.
We had many fruit trees on our property. Pear trees, apple trees, and cherries. We had it all. Now it's all left behind.
Makian's daughter, Lucine Emirian, was born and raised in Nagorno-Karabakh, but left when she got married in 2006. In the months leading up to Azerbaijan's military operation, Emirian and her mom stayed in close contact, frequently calling and texting each other. She was also in touch with her husband, who was in Nagorno-Karabakh as well. Emirian says he went there as a volunteer soldier. Her sister's husband also took up arms.
Сестра не знала, где его муж, и у моего мужа тоже не было, ну, не знали, где они.
My sister didn't know where her husband was. I didn't know where my husband was. People tried to search for them, but no one found them.
Emirian says her sister's husband was captured by Azerbaijani forces. He remains a prisoner of war in Baku as negotiations between Armenia and Azerbaijan continue. But her husband, Abil, is missing in action. She last heard from him a year ago.
More than anything else, I want to see my husband. Everything else is secondary. Of course I miss our homeland, but I don't have my husband. I don't know where he is. I want to see him more than anything.
Emirian says that talking about her husband is difficult for her. She tells me that she feels as if the pain will never pass. Back at the Tatev Monastery, Father Michael Gevorgian says that many people displaced from Nagorno-Karabakh come to him looking for advice.
Если еще рана кровотечет, надо кровь останавливать.
If the wound is still open, he says, you first need to stop the bleeding. Only then the healing begins. Healing from the loss of life and from the trauma of losing your home. For the world, I'm Daniel Hoffman, Yerevan, Armenia.
Our Artificial intelligence, or AI, it's being used more and more, but the questions about how AI is used are growing as fast as the technology. A year ago, the UN set out the task of getting nations to agree on some fundamentals about how to promote AI for the good of humanity and how to curb the problems AI can create. That document was released this week. It was written by Ian Bremmer, who is also president of the Eurasia Group think tank. He explained the proposal.
It's a framework to bring the world together to understand what the opportunities and risks of AI are. So, I mean, if we look at climate change, for example, we now have a world, everyone understands it's happening. There's 1.2 degrees centigrade of warming. We all know there's methane and carbon in the atmosphere. Then we have to figure out what we're going to do about it. So to start, it is to ensure that we all agree on the baseline of where we are on AI, what the big opportunities are for the world, what the challenges are.
So dig in a little more to what this panel would do.
The International Scientific Panel on Artificial Intelligence would be stood up as a regular meeting of both the scientific community, government representatives, private sector members to assess baseline where artificial intelligence as a technology has gotten, what the biggest priorities for its use for advancing humanity, both as a tool for human capital and productivity, as well as for companies and governments to use to increase innovation and efficiency, and also to share where those risks are, risks that could undermine the functioning of our economy, the national security of the world. What it is not is an agency with enforcement responsibility or power. In a world where Russia, China, the United States, Europe, the Global South don't agree on very much, there's been an astonishing amount of agreement that these are necessary recommendations. If you told me a year ago that we'd be at this position right now, you could have knocked me over with a stick.
So just get concrete here for us, Ian. What will be different if this goes forward?
Instead of having a bunch of headlines on artificial intelligence that are being solely driven by a small number of wealthy countries and corporations, that the world will have both understanding and a say in how we think about and deploy AI for everyone. This is not an oppositional conversation. This is a positive sum conversation. It took decades to get baseline understanding on climate change because you had so many different governments and companies whose interests were in ensuring that the science was obscured. That's not the case here. One of the reasons why I'm so much more optimistic about governance of AI is because when you talk about making sure that, let's say, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, South Asia, others have access to cutting-edge AI, it's not at the expense of the West. It's actually providing more human capital, more growth, more market opportunities. This is a positive sum game, but it's one that is forgotten because it's not the principal top priority of where the money is going right now. It's made it much easier to come up with agreements.
What are some of the concerns around AI that cannot be adequately handled at the national or regional level?
If you look at the relationship between the United States and China, where most of the cutting edge AI is presently being developed, these are two countries that don't trust each other. They have increasingly confrontational relations. And they're working to build AI in every space, including national security and military space, as fast as they can, lest their adversary develops an advantage. We've done this once before with the Soviets, with the nuclear race, and we didn't have any arms control agreements, not even conversations about them until after 1962. In other words, until after the Cuban Missile Crisis when we almost blew each other up. That's a little late. So certainly one of the things that needs to happen and that the UN can't do is that the Americans and the Chinese urgently need to start having AI arms control agreements, not to stop AI development, but to help be transparent about what we're doing and where are there areas that will blow each other up if we aren't careful, if we don't cooperate, if we don't share information. That's one area.
I mean, AI has been a reality in our world for a while already. I mean, just think autocorrect, right? Granted, it's evolved exponentially over autocorrect. But have you seen a situation already where not having substantial international governance of AI has been a problem?
You see it all the time. I mean, in disinformation. We know that human beings in the United States have rights to free speech, but AI bots don't. And yet, if you can't tell what is an AI bot and what is a human being, you are going to have a different view of what kind of, you know, things are true, what kind of actions you should take, what kind of information you should trust, and act accordingly. It's very hard to maintain civil society and democracy when you don't know if you're interacting with a human or not. So that's a place where AI has advanced beyond our ability to relate to it as individual citizens, and where we're going to need governance, not to shut it down, but to appropriately label it so we know what we're dealing with.
All examples you cite there that make one shudder. I mean, there's been a lot of doomsaying around AI, as you know. So why aren't you worried it could destroy humanity?
When I see a new technology like artificial intelligence and what that can be deployed to do, both in service of individuals that want to accomplish more with their labor, with their intellect, and also companies and governments that want to act more efficiently and more productively and invent things that are going to help us live more effectively on the planet, I get very excited. I get even more excited by that than I shudder from the risk.
Ian Bremmer leads the Eurasia Group think tank. We were speaking about his work as the UN rapporteur behind the proposal to create an international agreement around the use of artificial intelligence.
Hundreds of thousands of people have fled Somalia over the past 3 decades, leaving behind political instability and civil war in the East African nation. Now, across the globe, there's a trend of those displaced Somalis returning home to run for office. One man who has lived in Maine for over a decade is running to become governor of his former state in Somalia. Maine Public Radio's Ari Snyder brings us that story.
Like so many of his fellow Somali refugees, Abdullahi Ali was raised in refugee camps in Kenya. In 2009, he was resettled in Maine and soon found success here. He started a nonprofit that focuses on mental health and well-being in immigrant communities, got a doctorate in public policy from USM, and recently launched an aid organization to support communities in East Africa. Through that charity, Ali began making trips back to his home state of Jubaland in southern Somalia. He says he encountered a population grappling with violence, government corruption, and a lack of economic opportunity.
But also, there's so many good people with good intentions that want to and would love to see things change, but don't have the capacity to do so.
Ali says he was motivated to offer those people a hopeful vision of the future, one with greater government accountability and transparency. He helped form a new political party and threw his hat into the ring to run for president of Jubaland, one of 6 federal states in Somalia.
If, someone like me does not take the risk to bring about that change, who else will do it?
Ali moved to neighboring Kenya this summer, where he can meet with leaders from Jubaland and make trips to and from Somalia. Kenya is home to one of the largest Somali populations outside of Somalia, and Ali says he can't travel widely in Jubaland due to the strong presence of the insurgent group Al-Shabaab. Ali is joining a long tradition of displaced Somalis returning to seek public office.
So it's actually quite common in the Somalia context.
Omar Mahmoud is an East Africa policy analyst with the International Crisis Group. He says that's in part because many in the diaspora have been able to get political training and educational opportunities abroad that are not accessible in Somalia. Still, Jubaland is not an easy place to seek public office. The state is a stronghold for the extremist militant group Al-Shabaab, which controls much of the territory, severely limiting the regional government's authority. And Mahmoud says the incumbent president, who's held power for over a decade, is deeply entrenched.
He has control, complete control over government functions. He will have a lot of sway over how this election proceeds.
How and when the election proceeds is also in flux. Originally intended for November, Mahmoud says it'll likely get delayed. And despite growing interest in universal suffrage, he says the election will probably be decided by clan elders who select members of parliament, who in turn pick a president. Despite the uphill battle, Ali's campaign has galvanized many of his friends and supporters in Maine's Somali community, including Mohamed Khalid.
They're excited that someone, with Abdullahi's caliber, that actually doesn't have to do this, is doing this.
Khalid grew up in Lewiston and co-leads a civic engagement group focusing on communities of color in Maine. He also considers Ali a friend and mentor and says he's helping advise the campaign from afar. Khalid says Ali's candidacy represents a ray of hope for a more democratic future in Somalia.
Where there's, you know, women are uplifted, young people are uplifted, everyone has a say in what actually goes on in their community.
As he navigates the complex political currents of Jubaland's regional elections, Ali says he's trying to bridge two worlds. While engaging with and studying the U.S. political system, Ali says he came to see accountability and transparency as fundamental values for someone holding public office.
So I want to bring those values to my local community in Jubaland. But at the same time, I also want to understand and acknowledge that the environment is different, the culture is different, the people are different.
Ali says he's under no illusion that he alone can upend decades of insecurity, weak public institutions, and other challenges. But he says he at least wants to offer a platform for Somalis who want something different. If he doesn't win, Ali says he'll continue to stay engaged in Somali politics while also spending time in Maine.
For The World, I'm Ari Snyder, Portland, Maine.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. That is sound National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek recorded of some friends singing as they were all trekking across the old trading trails in Sichuan, China. Salopek walked through the country as part of his journey retracing the path of human migration on foot. Hiking through China required drinking and seeing lots of tea, which is what we're going to talk about today. It is great to talk to you again, Paul.
Hey, Carolyn. It's great to be back on.
So that singing we just heard, it was recorded while you were crossing a huge peak on an old tea trading route. Was it kind of motivation to get you up and over that peak?
Yeah, it was two of my Chinese walking partners who somewhat ironically were crooning the Internazionale, the communist kind of anthem in Chinese, as we headed up these trails that are quite old, centuries old, up over an 11,300-foot peak between Sichuan and kind of the outer edge of Tibet.
And one of the things you wrote about when you were in that region was that these trails for hundreds of years were traversed by tea porters. You have photos of these workers in your National Geographic dispatches from your journey, and they show this these massive bundles of dried tea, much taller and wider than the people who were carrying them. Can you describe those loads that they carried and where they were going?
Yeah, so for about 250 years until the last dynasty finished in China, there was a stream of, imagine these high kind of eastern outliers of the Himalaya Mountains, and they're a stream of ant-like porters going back and forth over a stretch of, you know, almost, I don't know, about 200 kilometers, that would be like 130 miles, up mountain passes,
wow,
down into canyons, all of them staggering in one direction towards Tibet, carrying kind of cheap black tea from Sichuan into Tibet. And these porters were amazing athletes, almost superhuman feats of crossing these passes, carrying up to 400 pounds of dried tea on their back, wrapped in bamboo packets. It's hard to imagine.
Wow, that is a staggering load. It sounds like incredibly difficult work. My question is, why were people carrying these loads and not pack animals, especially, as you said, into the 1900s?
Well, the mountains there are just so rugged that they defied the construction of roads for generations. This began, I think, back in the 1700s under the Qing. And I actually interviewed one of the last porters. He was an 89-year-old
wow,
man who carried tea when he was a teenager. But these walking trails, these tea kind of porter trails, they're called beifu, the porters, basically faded away in the early 1950s when the Chinese government began pushing roads into this area.
So tell me more about what you heard when you spoke to one of those last remaining tea porters. What did he say?
Well, it wasn't easy to find one to begin with because the last of them walked in the 1950s before being replaced by trucks. But I did in one village ask around and found a guy named Wang Shikang, and he was 89. And he had carried tea when he was kind of 17 or 18, quite young. And he was this elderly man who had kind of his face was kind of a mask of leathery flesh, his eyes glittering in it. And he remembered rheumatic knees, exhaustion, sleeping in bamboo inns along these mountains as he carried his load. And he said that, Paul, you know, there were bandits in these mountains back then. You know, today you get to walk through China. You don't have to fear about bandits, but we did. And he said that they'd never stole the tea from us. What can you do with 400 pounds of tea in the middle of a wilderness, right? They waited till we got paid, and then they hit us when we had a few coins in our pocket on our way back home.
Oh, yeah, man.
Yeah, so hazard of the job.
Right. On your journey through Sichuan, you also visited a tea plantation. It sounds very tranquil there. What did it feel like to walk through that plantation?
Tea plantations are always stunningly beautiful. They look like, you know, manicured hedgerows. Here's this woody bush. It's the genus and species is Camilla sinensis. It's the classic tea bush. It evolved in this area. It evolved in southwestern China, what is part of today's Tibet, maybe a bit of Burma, northeastern India. This is the epicenter of tea cultivation going back 3,000 years. And so it was a real treat.
And tea is still picked by hand there?
Absolutely. It's considered like premium tea. So hand-picked tea is often the best. These folks were masters at it, as you might imagine. They were quite old, right? This is not just this tea plantation, but everywhere in China and rural China, it's mainly elderly people who are left doing kind of farming jobs. That included this remote hilltop plantation. People in their 70s, even older in their 80s. And they're using kind of their thumbnail and their index finger to pluck off the last tiny tip of the branch. They call it white tea, the palest, youngest little tips of leaves. Premium tea.
Mm. So quite a skill they've developed over the years, I imagine.
Well, they certainly outclassed me. I was kind of the butt of many, many tea jokes. Let's put it that way.
This young whippersnapper has no idea what he's doing.
Yeah, by comparison. Yes. Yeah. So, and it was like a commune. It was very odd. You know, it was like a collection of people you might find kind of in a hippie commune. There was an old a man who was a martial arts expert. There was a woman who was like rebuilding this temple because Buddha told her to. It was kind of a spiritual community. It was quite interesting.
So you mentioned this region is kind of the cradle of tea cultivation. Is this where tea drinking got its start way back in history?
As far as people know, I mean, it's really hard to pinpoint it. There are all kinds of legends, and everybody wants to be the kind of the cradle of tea. But botanists say pretty much wild tea, if you date back the genes through time, probably originated in these hills. Yeah, it was the first sip of tea happened somewhere around this temple.
And was the tea there especially delicious?
Oh my God, Carolyn. I mean, yeah, if you like tea, it is like being in tea heaven because they have black teas, they have green teas, they have brown teas, they have yellow teas, they have white teas, white tea being kind of the most elite, which is what these people were harvesting. It was quite an essential experience, yeah.
I know there are parts of the world where a cup of tea first is a prerequisite for anything. An interview, a conversation, coming into someone's home. Tell the truth, by the end of your time in China, were you ready for maybe a cup of coffee or a break from all the tea?
Well, you know, for better or for worse, coffee has invaded China. So in the big cities, in the cosmopolitan centers, younger people are not drinking as much tea like their elders. They're drinking Starbucks or the Chinese versions of Starbucks, right? So tea has some competition now.
You say that more young people are drinking more coffee. Is there any fear that tea drinking and tea cultivation, these great traditions in China, will die out eventually?
You know, I don't know the answer to that, but my sense is no, I don't want to go that far. I mean, it's so embedded in a sense of comfort, a sense of greeting, a sense of welcome is to have a little glass of tea. It's just, yeah, it's ingrained and almost in kind of daily ritual.
That's Paul Salopek. He's a National Geographic explorer. We've been retracing his walk around the globe, following the trail of human development and migration. See more of his journey online at outofedenwalk.nationalgeographic.org and at our website, theworld.org.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow. From PRX.